talk tonight is on relationships. There was a man. He was a dreamy personality. He admired artists and poets and mystics. In fact, he considered himself to be one. An artist, a poet, and a mystic, that is. Anyone who lived in a universe that was unstructured, that had no form, no defined edges, that was peopled with dramatic pictures, beautiful words and unusual experiences, and seemed to be in touch with something other, something more mysterious, something deeper than this drab, solid world he observed through his senses. This type of person he admired. He put them on a pedestal and worshipped them like a god. He admired this conglomerate image of his perfect person so much that he drove himself to be like his mental creation, like his mental god. It came to pass that he lost his job. When this happened, he felt very insecure, very frightened. He was worried about whether he could get another job, whether he could afford his accommodation. Friends asked him about his attempts to find re-employment, at which he was having little success. And he always replied with a laugh and a shrug and an apparent unconcerned air, and replied, "I'm not having much success, but something is bound to turn up. And anyhow, I just go with the flow of things. It doesn't concern me. I'm above these things. I'm not troubled by life's ups and downs." It is at this point in the relationship that the person he was talking to became, the relationship became strained. His friend felt uneasy with the reply, feeling that there was something wrong with it, but was unable to put his finger on just what it was. And so an uneasy, awkward air settled over the conversation, with both parties feeling threatened and each rapidly building a wall around themselves for protection from a threat they couldn't define. Where the man had gone wrong with his friend was that he had presented a super image, the image he wished to be, the image of a mystic. He had refused to be himself. His words had described what he thought was the way an enlightened being responded to life's vicissitudes. He imagined that the enlightened person was not bothered as to whether he was employed or unemployed. He just sailed through life in an equanimous fashion, untouched by anything. This man desperately wanted others to see him as an advanced meditator, to worship him and to admire him. So with words, he described how he thought he was responding to life, thereby confusing himself and others. Because what was really going on for him was that he was scared stiff. He was terrified. His stomach would twist up at the very thought of unemployment. When talking with his friend, all his nonverbal communication signals would shout, "I'm scared, I'm terrified." But his voice said, "I'm serene, I'm fine, life's wonderful." He lied. His listener, at a subconscious level, knew he lied, knew he was indulging in spiritual conceit. But this information didn't surface into the friend's conscious mind, so he didn't know what was going on. He just knew he felt uneasy, that he was having the wool pulled over his eyes, and that there was some kind of contradiction here. The man himself, by his words, was undercutting his attempts to walk the spiritual path. He was undercutting all the hours he put into the seated practice. Because by telling his friend what he wanted to be present in his mind, who is blocking out what was actually present. The trap was saying with what one thinks ought to be present, rather than what is present, is that it doesn't take long before the meditator starts to believe his or her own words, thus deepening the fantasy world lived in, and strengthening the roots of confusion and ignorance. The meditator is then moving rapidly away from reality, not going at all in the direction he wants to go and thinks he's going, which is towards nirvana. From the meditative point of view, what the man should have said when asked about being unemployed was, "I'm feeling insecure. I'm worried. I would like to feel otherwise, but I don't." Then he would not confuse himself. He would be stating what was actually present in his mind, not what he would like to be present. His verbal and non-verbal signals would be the same. His friend would not feel threatened by the confused signals. The communication channel between them would stay open instead of slamming shut with barriers being erected all round. Then the next step in the meditative process would be to learn how not to push out the unpleasant feeling that arises dependent upon thoughts about unemployment, but to let it stay for as long as it wishes to stay, to observe its presence, and to observe its ceasing. With continued practice in the right way, the meditator would gradually learn not to play around with, not to keep going over in mind, thoughts about unemployment, realizing that there is no mileage to be gained from constantly churning over thoughts about will I or won't I get another job. All that does is to bring deeper and deeper distress. He would learn to turn the thoughts about unemployment into a meditation object, to be watched come and go. And he would learn to watch come and go the unpleasant feelings that arose dependent upon those thoughts. One side of relationships so rarely considered is the interplay between the male and female aspects within ourselves. We spend vast quantities of time analyzing, pondering over, worrying about our relationships with males and females in our external environment. But rarely do we pause to consider our internal relationships, and even whether such a thing exists. If we are born into this world with a body that has all the right accoutrements of the female species, and then the environment in which we grow up supports this view by giving us dolls and nurses' outfits to play with, not guns or mechanical toys. It encourages us to bake cakes, to look after the house, generally to nurture, to be gentle and submissive. We then tend just to accept the view that we are female and that the male principle exists external to ourselves. But does it? What are the masculine psychological traits? What are the feminine psychological traits? The male qualities are goal orientation, driving towards that goal, the capacity and the need to see patterns in the universe, otherwise called logic. Masculinity is thrusting, it's penetrative, it's aggressive, it's idealistic, it's purposeful, it's structured, and it's driving. It is symbolized by lightning, which is sharp, sudden, illuminating, striking, and penetrative. Femininity is taking in, absorbing, non-differentiating, nurturing. It's emotional, dreamy, touchy, imaginative, creative, and moody. It is symbolized by the earth, which absorbs, takes into itself positive and negative substances without judgment, and then provides a basis for food to grow to feed us, trees to grow to shade us, flowers to grow to beautify our world. Femininity is also symbolized by a chalice, which again is an object which holds and contains substances, whereas lightning thrusts through substances. So masculinity penetrates into, and femininity receives. Each person has, contained within their psychological makeup, both feminine and masculine qualities. And for each person, there exists an imbalance in these qualities. Either there is too much centering, too much living in the feminine principle, or else too much identification with the masculine side. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with the physical sex of that person. But having said that, it is more common to find the masculine qualities more developed in a male and the feminine qualities somewhat underdeveloped, and vice versa. Because we sense a lack of certain qualities within ourselves, we go searching externally for them. We form relationships with people of both sexes who have those feminine or masculine qualities which we lack and which we need to feel balanced, to feel secure. To have external relationships fill in our psychological gaps is fine, provided we don't leave it at this and demand that beings external to ourselves supply our missing qualities. If we do this, not only do we limit our mental and spiritual growth, but also our relationships. Ultimately, we have to grow to the point where we allow free expression of both the male and female qualities within ourselves. We all have both sets. Neither masculinity nor femininity is in actual fact missing. But what we've done is to repress one set, or some of the aspects of one set, in favor of the other. Partly due to social conditioning, but mainly due to our inability to handle, with ease, those factors we have repressed. We admire either the masculine or feminine qualities, and tend to direct all our views and energies towards the expression of those, thus hiding their opposites. When we are in a position where we have allowed up into the conscious side of the mind, both our feminine and masculine qualities, and this most definitely comes with meditation practice, and we are giving full expression to both, only then do we feel truly balanced, completely at ease and in harmony with ourselves. It is only when we have reached the point of being able to have a total relationship with every aspect of ourselves that we are able and capable of having a total relationship with someone else. Because once we are no longer demanding that others supply the qualities we think we lack, we don't lack them, we just refuse to allow their expression. Only when we have stopped demanding from others can we give them room to breathe, can we allow them to be themselves. This is true giving. For we are no longer taking from them to fill ourselves. We are just being with them. No longer are we demanding that they should be like this or that. We are accepting them for what they are. We are allowing them space to be themselves. It is only when we are allowing both our masculine and feminine side to exist, for the various qualities of each polarity to come into existence and fade out moment by moment. It is only when we are in this state that we can have a full and complete relationship with another being. Before this point is reached, we are always demanding, wanting. The relationship is tinged with an element of craving. When clarity of mindfulness begins to run and we see more and more the way the mind operates, should we at this time be involved in a pleasing relationship which comes to an end? We may be sickened by what we discover about ourselves. For when we look closely, we see it's not the loss of the person that bothers us, but it's the loss of the pleasant feeling we mourn. That pleasant feeling that arose within us when we were together, when we thought about that person. It is that feeling that we yearn for, crave for. A human being is like a diamond. A diamond has many sides or facets and reflects light in many different ways. We are like this. We are many-sided and present many facets of ourselves to different people. We are constructed of hundreds of different positive and negative qualities. And when we are with someone, that person draws out of us only a certain number of those qualities. And our personality likewise draws out only certain qualities from the person we are with. So the two people relating to one another form an event which is unique to those two people. Add an extra person, and the psychological chemistry is changed. A new event is created, and the qualities drawn out of each person is slightly different, sometimes radically different. The relationship that exists between you and your wife, or you and your husband, or you and your boss, or you and your child, is unique to the two of you, and therefore private. Nobody else can share in that relationship, because the moment someone else comes to observe that relationship, their very presence alters the facets displayed, and the relationship changes. It's no longer what it was. Where our problems start is that we have a super image of ourselves. And this super image is what we wish to present to everyone, adult and child alike. And most of all, we desire that the image remains constant under all circumstances. For many, many people, the super image they strive to present to the outside world runs something along the lines of always being kind, tolerant, fair-minded, patient, strong, etc. Of course, this image varies slightly from person to person. And the demands of the superimage can never, ever be met. For it's inhuman. It consists only of positive qualities. And no living, breathing human being is ever like that. The superimage is a mental construct, a concept, a thought form, a ghost, which doesn't match what is actually present in any one person at all. Because it is a superimage and not what we actually are, we fall short of it time and time again. And each time we fall short, we hate ourselves. We chew ourselves up. We wish we were something other than we are. And we promise ourselves that someday, in the future, someday when we've done sufficient meditation, when we're wise enough, and have got ourselves under control, then we will be that super image. And when we are that super image, we will be at peace. So peace equals something off in the future when we are different. all such thinking is adhamma. That is, it's against the truth. It is heading in the opposite direction from peace. Such concepts will not decrease our suffering, only increase it. For peace is not to be found off in some mythical future. It is here in the moment, and hinges round us learning how to stay in the moment, learning how to accept ourselves just as we are. Then the mind makes no movement. It rests happily in the moment. Part of the meditative process is noticing, firstly, that we are different personalities to different people. But not only that, also noticing that we change even within the one relationship. Sometimes we present a positive facet, sometimes a negative one. And which facet is displayed will depend totally on whether there is craving or hatred, or non-craving or non-hatred, present in the minds of the people relating. Perhaps you are pottering away at home, quite happy, feeling at peace with the world, singing a happy tune, and your boyfriend walks in through the door. And before you know where you are, you're bitching and nagging at him. There's a distinct tone of irritability to your mind, which has swept away completely the calm that was there only a moment ago. You learn from your boyfriend that he has had a major row with his boss. It's obvious that he's seething and that hatred is running in his mind. The presence in your immediate environment of a mind filled with hatred is to trigger off within you negative rather than positive qualities. By the time you become aware of these negative mental states, they have already arisen and died. They have ceased, they have finished. The trick from the meditative point of view is to learn how to walk the middle path between indulgence and repression. Indulgence is falling into the irritability, the hatred, and building on it. Repression is not even noticing the anger present in your mind, but always overlaying it by presenting a calm front, a super image, whilst underneath this front, hatred seethes and boils. Such a person only notices the calm, pleasant front. The trick is not to blot out the anger just because you don't want it to be there, but to notice its presence, not to fall in and build upon it, but just to notice it coming and going. As a meditator becomes more successful at this approach, so he or she notices just how many faces they do seem to have. Then they get worried and say, "Which one is me?" The answer to that question is that we are all of these faces. And if we don't interfere with the flow, we notice that they come and go rapidly. The more we meditate, the more we seem to ourselves to be like an ever-changing chameleon. Then the next question that so often arises to plague the mind of the meditator is, am I not being false by wearing different faces for different people? The answer is surprising, because the answer is no. No, we are not being false. We are being false when we try to maintain one constant face to all people under all circumstances. When we do this, we are going against the flow of reality, because we are trying to stop change. And one of the marks of existence, one of the root truths about life, is that things change. What we are effectively saying when we try to present a constant face is that there is no such thing as change. We are saying, also, that we are independent, that we have a separate self, which is not influenced by other people's minds or by circumstances. Thus, by trying to maintain a constant face, we deny another root of existence, another truth about life. We deny anatta. We deny non-self. We deny that things are interdependent. And the meaning of anatta is that things are interdependent. The more a person meditates, the more they come to realize that if there is hatred running in the mind, then there is a looking about in the environment for something or someone to find fault with, and that the person closest to them will always receive the brunt of the attack, be it one's husband, wife, child, or meditation teacher. Before meditating, or in the early days of one's training, there is a tendency to think that our hatreds, our resentments, our jealousies, our envies are caused by other people, by other people being hateful and thoughtless, etc. But as the practice matures, we see clearly, oh so clearly, that nobody causes the negative and positive mental states that well up inside us. All the husband or wife or child is a supporting condition upon which a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling arises. And when thoughts of complaint about the other person start to run, what is happening is that the mind is trying to get away from an unpleasant feeling. But because our mindfulness is not sharp enough, we do not realize that it is the feeling we are trying to get away from, but think that it is the person we are wanting to get away from. Because the feeling comes and goes so quickly, and we don't notice it, but only notice the person entering the room, and then our negative thoughts about that person, we jump to the mistaken conclusion that if the other person wasn't there, or if they were different in some way, then life would be wonderful. Sometimes the unpleasant feeling doesn't come and go quickly, but it is there for some time, and we are aware of it, but we don't understand its place in the scheme of things, and so still jump to the wrong conclusion, and think it is the person we don't like, and that it is him or her that is causing our hatreds, when in actual fact, what we don't like is the unpleasant feeling. It is the unpleasant feeling we hate. I do not wish to minimize the role our husband or our wife or our child or whoever plays in the event. The negative thoughts and unpleasant feelings arise dependent upon the past and present supporting circumstances. The past is that we've let hatred run before. It's made a groove in the mind and therefore is easily triggered off with the right supporting conditions. The supporting condition is the other person and their mental state. The more we see that we only find fault with someone when there is hatred in the mind, this seeing helps us to pause and put the brakes on before we blast out verbally. And with time and continued practice, we start to pause and put the brakes on before we blast someone mentally. With time and practice, we start to stay with the uncomfortable feeling as it arises, with the mind neither liking nor disliking it, not moving away from it or adding to it, but just staying with the uncomfortable feeling. And should we decide it is more efficient to verbally blast, or it just comes out in spite of ourselves, then we stay with that experience. We don't add to it after the event, saying to ourselves, we wish we had behaved differently. when this whole process starts to grow, our relationships with those close to us begins to change for the better. Have you noticed with a child how happy it can be when alone with its mother? Then introduce a third party, a friend of the mother's, say, who pops in for tea. And the child suddenly becomes fractious. It becomes grisly, starts interrupting the conversation the adults are holding. It insists that mother helps it build a house with bricks. And if mother tells the child off and refuses to do what the child wants, there's tears and tantrums. We are like this. We have tears and tantrums when we are not the center of attention in a relationship. I refer here to a close adult relationship. It is unfortunate that we label this desire to be the center of someone's universe as childish. It is a label that can cause a lot of anguish. With a deepening understanding of rebirth, one starts to view children as adults imprisoned in a small, cumbersome body, which takes many years to learn how to handle and coordinate, and then several more years to learn how to become sophisticated in the society they move in. Sophisticated here means learning how to put a gloss over those natural and automatic emotional responses that arise, which adults label childish. The gloss takes the form of suppression, or repression, or control. When one begins to view children as adults and begins to become more aware of one's own mental content, one becomes a little more cautious about labeling a particular emotion or way of behaving as childish, having seen it occur within oneself. The desire to be close to another human being and the center of their attention is not childish. How can it be if everyone experiences it, whether child or adult? Adults are just more cunning at hiding their emotions and thoughts. They've acquired a sophisticated gloss. So the first thing to note is that the desire to be close to is natural, and everyone experiences it to a greater or lesser degree sometime in their lifetime. The problem with a sophisticated gloss is that so often we don't notice this desire to be the center of someone's universe. And we make actions upon it all the same, and are puzzled as to why the relationship seems to be going a bit sour, and why we feel out of sorts. Gradually, with the meditation, the gloss begins to crack, and we notice how petulant we get when our loved one is absorbed in something or someone else. We try to manipulate the accompanying unpleasant feeling by scolding ourselves and telling ourselves not to be so childish. After all, I'm an adult and should have tolerant adult responses to life. The trouble with this sort of thinking is that it stirs up self-hatred for ourselves and our childish emotions. From a meditative point of view, the way to deal with such thoughts and emotions within ourselves is to realize that they are natural and are bound to come up from time to time in a close relationship, and that they are not childish, just ordinary old mental states and mental objects. This helps to cut down the self-hatred and the clinging to the jealousy. And then we do our very best to just watch the hatred, the jealousy, the accompanying thoughts rise and pass away and not get embroiled in them. A person comes to meditation, let's say it's a woman. She dresses in strong contrasting colors. They're aggressive colors and reflect the strong hate root in her character, She meditates, and gradually, slowly, an inner revolution takes place. Inroads are made into understanding and seeing clearly the process of hatred. With this clear seeing, insights grow and the hatred lessens. This inner change is reflected externally in a complete change in the contents of her wardrobe. Cloth colors now chosen are softer in color, and the colors go together. They harmonize rather than clash. If you ever notice that a friend of yours, whether male or female, suddenly goes out and buys a new set of clothes which are completely different in color and style from anything they have ever worn before, it's a sign that a major psychological change has occurred for that person. Going back to our female meditator, who's now wearing clothes in different colors and softer, more feminine lines, not the plain, stark designs formerly worn, which reflected the aggressive masculine side of the personality. She will now find that she starts to get compliments from male and female alike of how good she looks. Many, in giving their compliments, will not realize that not only are they commenting on her more beautiful exterior, but they're also perceiving an inner beauty that is beginning to grow, and they are commenting on this just as much as they are on the exterior beauty. That they have also noticed an inner change does not float fully into the conscious mind, and all they can find themselves saying is, "You look good tonight. That color really suits you." Such a meditator, on receiving compliments, will begin to glow inwardly from the praise. If you remember back to the lectures on the different character types, a hate type should be given the best room in a meditation center, with clean, well-made sheets, choice, tasty food, and be surrounded by people who are respectful and friendly towards that meditator. All of this helps to lessen the self-hatred. Our female meditator, on receiving compliments, begins to feel less hatred for herself, and therefore for the world about her. The hatred lessening, the mind gets calmer. The mind getting calmer improves the concentration. The concentration improving improves the mindfulness. Mindfulness improving, the insights grow. Insights growing lessens the hatred, the craving, and the ignorance. A really positive cycle has begun to unfold here. The meditator has worked hard at the meditation. This has brought about a clearing out of some of the hatred. It is externally symbolized by change in clothing. People praise and comment on the change. This makes her feel good about herself, thus lessening the hatred further. All of this encourages her to strive even harder at the meditation. The lessening of the hatred not only improves her inner universe, but also lessens the tension in her relationships, so beautifying and improving the universe of those close to her. Thank you.